President Volodymyr Zelensky tells Al Jazeera he regrets Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in the 1990s, and he names several governments that could give security guarantees to protect his country. One of them is China, another is Russia. But will anyone actually do that? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Rob Matheson. Ukraine is preparing for what it says will be fierce fighting with Russian forces. President Volodymyr Zelensky told Al Jazeera that Russia could renew its attack on Kyiv if Ukrainian forces fail on the Eastern Front. Mass evacuations have been carried out in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. On Friday, more than 50 people were killed in a strike on a railway station. Ukraine says Russia fired missiles while thousands of civilians were waiting to catch trains. Russia says it's not to blame. It says Kyiv is responsible. Ukrainian forces have managed to retake other towns, and Zelensky says that's giving people new hope.
We can see that the war is not over yet. But so many people are excited and happy that some areas have been liberated. And I'm pleased to speak about such places, because in others, people are dying. Some because of the blockades, and others because they're being killed by Russian soldiers. But we have put up a fierce response, and they've failed to take Kyiv.
Well, President Zelensky also says that if Ukraine was to be a neutral or non-aligned country, it would need security guarantees from foreign governments, and Russia would have to be part of that.
I think that this agreement would be impossible without Russian Federation, so that's another story, really. Then I know that Ireland wanted, and some other countries wanted, to consider becoming security guarantors. We will also ask for China. France and Germany, they also are aware of this situation, and so far they are showing some sort of respect and support, but in addition to support and assistance, we need to have very detailed negotiations in order to understand which country is ready to provide which specific support and assistance and guarantees.
And Zelensky suggests Ukraine became weak and at greater risk from invasion when it gave away its nuclear capabilities without first securing stronger guarantees than those in the Budapest Memorandum of 1994.
Budapest Memorandum.
How could you give up the weapons in such a way without signing any serious document, just making a big present? For what? Who have received that? I mean, what have received, what Ukraine have received? We have received a war. And this is one of the reasons we have become weaker. We have weakened our status, our defense. We have weakened our population. This is what we have given away. We have given away the life of those people who died. This is one of the reasons. Now, once again, I would like to reiterate, it's not because you would be willing to use that. Absolutely not.
Okay, let's bring in our guests. Peter Zelmayev is Executive Director of Eurasia Democracy Initiative. He's joining us on Skype from near Kyiv. And from Brussels, David O'Sullivan is a former Secretary General of the European Commission. He's currently Director General of the Institute of International and European Affairs. And from Glasgow in the UK, Anton Babashin is the editorial director at Riddle Russia. It's an online journal on Russian affairs. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for being with us. I want to talk about this reference that the president of Ukraine has made with regard to nuclear weapons. Peter, let me start with you. If Ukraine still had nuclear weapons after the 1990s, what could we have been seeing in Ukraine now?
Well, you know, that remark actually he first made during the Munich Security Conference a few days before the invasion. I was there in the room when he said it, and the Russians actually then later used this as an excuse, you know, as one of the, you know, their, you know, reasons to start the war. That, look, Ukraine is gung-ho about going nuclear and they're going to nuke us. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, Russians would have used any pretext, you know, to do so. They don't need a pretext, obviously. When I was getting my master's degree at Columbia University, one of my professors was Kenneth Waltz, a very well-known theoretician of the so-called theory of nuclear peace, according to which nuclear weapons are, you know, probably the closest countries have to a security-clad guarantee of their, you know, security. You know, needless to say, you know, when you're dealing with a country like Russia, it does appear that Ukraine would have been probably better off if it had kept its nuclear weapons. And that's why we have this situation. This is where we are right now. And we're trying to find a formula which would be the next best thing to, you know, NATO membership for Ukraine, but that will be the topic of our discussion today.
David O'Sullivan, if I understand it correctly, many of the nuclear weapons we were talking about in the 1990s were actually Soviet weapons, and the Ukrainians had access to them, but the Russians, at least in the early days, had the codes for them. Do you think that Ukraine was wise to give up that nuclear power? And did it actually have much of a nuclear power to begin with?
Well, I think that's a very good point, Rob. Indeed, they were Soviet weapons. They were based in Ukraine, and Ukraine had physical access to them. But I also understand that there were some limits to their ability actually to use them or to fire them. I also understand that meant a lot of the equipment was already somewhat degraded. And not in very good shape. So my personal view, I mean, I perfectly understand why Ukraine feels extremely cheated, particularly from the guarantees that were given of their territorial sovereignty in return for letting the weapons go back to Russia. But honestly, I don't think it was viable for a relatively small country in the middle of Europe to be nuclear armed. I think it would have caused more problems for Ukraine rather than solving any. And I think it could have been quite destabilizing in the region. So I think that Ukraine made the right decision at the time, but they are absolutely right to point out that the guarantees they got in return for doing that have not been respected by Russia. And this, of course, is a flagrant breach of the undertakings which were given, which started with the annexation of Crimea.
I want to come on to the security guarantees in a moment. But Anton Barbashin, do you think, given what our two previous speakers have said, that it would have made any difference at all if Ukraine had access to some sort of nuclear power, some sort of nuclear force? Would it have made any difference to Russia?
Well, I have to say that I agree fully with what was already said. I mean, at the time in the early 90s, it absolutely made sense for Ukraine to give it up. And of course, it would have made the situation completely different if in 2014 Ukraine had that. But at the moment, we're only seeing that the talk of nuclear Ukraine is being used, instrumentalized by Russian propaganda to kind of beef up the efforts to demilitarize Ukraine.
Okay, let's talk about the security guarantees that the president has been talking about. In the clip that we heard earlier on, he gave a list of countries that could be security guarantors. I want to ask, first of all, Anton, I'm going to stay with you. What is your understanding of what is involved in being a security guarantor under circumstances like this?
Well, that's an extremely interesting question, and I do not quite understand what sort of security guarantees mean in the moment. I mean, when the talk of it initially came up, it was, I think, phrased as something close to the Article 5 of NATO, which sounds quite bizarre because Russian side actually did not comment all that much on that because they knew quite well that this is something European nations would not be able to provide to Ukraine. So this is all rhetoric. I mean, it's nothing. No one could guarantee Ukraine to intervene to give it more than it's already giving at the moment, or to give something that it was Ukraine was denied, for instance, de facto membership of NATO. So I don't really think that at this point we're quite there yet to be discussing who could be the security guarantees, because the war is still enveloping. We are probably going to see heavy fighting next week and pretty much throughout April. At least Moscow is still focused on achieving a decisive military victory on the ground. So all the talk about potential security guarantees, well, is a bit premature.
Peter, what's your assessment of this talk of security guarantees? Is this just rhetoric, or could it actually lead to something, the basis of some sort of discussion at the very least?
Well, I absolutely agree with the previous speaker. You know, this is not a very tenable topic on the eve of a decisive battle. What is promising to be a decisive battle, you know, with tank armies and artillery. This is what the Ukrainian side is saying we should be expecting, and Ukraine is getting heavy weaponry as well, not only defensive but offensive. You know, so we're staring at a very, very difficult scenario in the next 2 weeks. And keep in mind, May 9th is a sacred, date in calendar Italy over the Nazi Germany. Vladimir Putin is going to have to pony up some victories to show his subjects during the military parade. So it's all going to be obviously decided on the battlefield, not diplomatically. After that, and Vladimir Zelensky has said this, you know, he does believe that only by meeting Vladimir Putin personally, we could hope for some kind of a breakthrough, diplomatic breakthrough, but only after Ukraine wins the battle. I mean, it's contrary to what we, you know, grow up hearing from diplomats. You know, there's no military solution to this or that conflict. Unfortunately, we are at a point where only a military solution is feasible, and only after a decisive showing by Ukraine's military. And let me just add a few points. You know, there's several issues remain very thorny, and without them, we cannot hope for any sort of discussion of a security guarantee unless Russia commits to paying Ukraine reparations. Hundreds of billions of dollars of damage has been inflicted on Ukraine's infrastructure. Needless to say, countless lives. We don't know the exact figure, but it may be thousands and thousands and thousands. Then the very difficult question of territorial concessions. I mean, are we talking about pre-February 24th withdrawal of troops, right, or pre-2014. Obviously, without the withdrawal of troops, at least to the positions before the 24th of February, we cannot talk about any significant, you know, breakthrough. And finally, Kyiv has said that there will be no diplomatic agreement, no peace, if it involves whitewashing Russian war crimes during the invasion, obviously Bucha.
David, I want to ask you, because just sort of to talk about this this idea of security guarantee, because it's interesting why the president should feel it's appropriate to bring it up, given the points that the gentlemen have already made. And also one would imagine that if, like the list he gave of possible guarantors included the US, the UK and Russia, if those guarantors were in place, then surely if there was any incident at all in Ukraine, it could bring those guarantors directly into conflict with each other. And one would imagine foreign governments do not want to do that, which is actually what we're seeing at the moment with NATO.
Yes, I think I understand what President Zelensky was trying to do. He was trying to, on the one hand, concede that Ukraine would not join NATO, which is, you know, a sort of slightly false, but nonetheless, that it is the line that Moscow is peddling. But at the same time, he was trying to give his country a secure future by saying, well, we're not going to join NATO, but we want the rest of you collectively to agree to underwrite our security. And he wants the permanent members of the UN Security Council. He wants a range of other countries. Now, I agree entirely with the two previous speakers, Anton and Peter, that frankly, this is not the subject of the moment, and will only come back if and when the military situation has created a situation where diplomacy becomes relevant again. But I do see what the president was trying to do. I'm skeptical as to whether it's achievable. We've had it in the past. There were guarantors for Cyprus, the UK, Greece, and Turkey, and then Turkey was one of the guarantors and invaded northern Cyprus, neither of the other two could do anything about it. So, the history of these things is not particularly happy. So I understand the idea. I get what the president was trying to put into play, but there are many, many obstacles to making such a move successful. And the difference, I think, is that he wants a really binding international treaty, very different in nature to the Budapest Memorandum, which was the guarantees on territorial sovereignty given after the exchange of the nuclear weapons. So I think he's looking for a much more legally binding instrument. And as you say, I think any country will be very wary to sign up to that if it means that they might have to commit troops in the event of an incident.
Mm. You've all referred to the coming conflict that we're going to see in Ukraine that the president himself has referred to, particularly in the east. Anton, let me ask you. So far, we have seen Russia move towards Kiev, but stop. We've seen it move towards Mariupol and destroy much of Mariupol. There seems to be a suggestion it is, if not pulling back, then refocusing towards the east of the country. What's your assessment of why Russia is doing that? What Putin is trying to achieve by making that initial move and then moving back?
Well, I think the answer is quite obvious. It was the initial miscalculation of how easy it would be for Russian troops to march through Ukraine. And in fact, it turned out to be quite messy, got quite bloody, and Russian troops were not able to acquire the goals that they had in plan and store for them. So they are just counting on the fact that they still could amass a significant enough group of forces in the east of Ukraine to essentially crush Ukrainian military resistance, to claim a certain amount of territory, and probably to incorporate that either in DPR, DLNR, or directly into the Russian state and claim this to be some sort of intermediary scenario for the day. But this regrouping essentially is happening there because they were not able to accomplish what was initially planned, because Russia is taking heavy losses and Ukraine is fighting quite fiercely. So this is not a strategy A and probably not even strategy B. It's probably plan C, if I can, look into that this way.
Mm. David, Anton referred to the fact that Moscow wanted, quote, a decisive military victory on the ground. Do you think that that is what we're leading up to in the next few weeks, or indeed months, I guess, because there is a prediction, of course, this could go on for a very long time?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I'm not a military strategist, and I certainly don't pretend to know what's going on inside the head of President Putin. I think that the explanation given is the most plausible, that they clearly have not had the early military victory that they hoped. They had hoped, I think, to take Kyiv, install a puppet government and basically declare victory. The Ukrainian fierce resistance at huge cost, but with great bravery, has stopped that. And I think, indeed, they are falling back perhaps to a military outcome which can be described as a victory. That's what it looks like. But listen, there are could be many twists and turns in this before we see anything like a ceasefire or a cessation of hostilities. So I think we need to be very, very careful in predictions, because quite a few of them have proven to be misplaced in the early stages of this conflict and even more recently. So I think it is the most plausible explanation, but I wouldn't say that Mr. Putin has completely given up on the idea, perhaps, of a wider military victory, or perhaps linking the eastern provinces with Crimea down through the south of Ukraine. There are probably a number of different ideas circulating in Russian military circles, and it's a question of what they think they can win at. And this is probably going to be tested now in the next few weeks.
Peter, you were nodding through that. Do you get the feeling that, as far as negotiations are concerned, there's really not much point in trying to work out whether or not negotiations are actually working until we get to the point that our previous two guests have talked about, and Russia has got what it regards as a definitive military victory?
Indeed, you know, I would break my answer into two components. First of all, I would corroborate what David has just said, that, you know, Putin has not only not been dissuaded from his idea to continue this war in Ukraine, concentrated on the Donbass. I'm not even sure he's not been dissuaded from trying to storm Kyiv a second time. German Chancellor Scholz has recently said that he is afraid that Putin's advisors are not giving him the full picture of what is happening in Ukraine, are not giving him the precise figures of the number of soldiers lost. The Ukrainians have reported a number of almost 20,000 military dead. We're not sure if Mr. Putin, deep in his bunker, is still not receiving, you know, the true picture of what's happening. You know, and the second one is that, you know, once again, Mr. Putin is hell-bent on destroying Ukraine as not just a political entity, but as a culture. There was a very widely quoted piece published on the RIA Novosti, RIA News, which is a governmental website, a few days ago, following Bucha, which spelled out what Russia's goals should be in Ukraine. And basically, the gist of the article is that, you know, it's clear that it's no longer this some kind of anti-Russian junta ruling Kiev, but the entire, you know, Ukrainian people is very much against Russians, against Russia. And so Russia needs to solve the Ukrainian question by trying to, you know, get rid of Ukrainian culture, to de-Ukrainianize Ukraine. It's no longer denazification or demilitarization. It's de-Ukrainization, folks. So we take that, the theoretical, we take the practical, Bucha, and we have all the inklings of genocide that is being committed in Ukraine. Mm.
David, we mentioned right at the top of the program that the President Zelensky has told Al Jazeera that Russia could renew its attack on Kyiv if Ukraine forces fail to hold Russia on the Eastern Front. Is there a concern, do you think, in Ukraine that foreign governments may, frankly, lose interest if the fighting moves further east and towards the Russian government?
I don't know what the people in Ukraine are thinking. I would say, seen from Brussels with NATO and the EU, I think that would not be the case. I mean, I think people understand that this is a hugely important conflict. I mean, first and foremost, because of the enormous suffering of the Ukrainian people, the refugees, the deaths, the destruction of property. It's horrible. And none of us ever thought we would live to see this in Europe in our lifetime. And people have understood that, you know, this is Mr. Putin's war. And this is, you know, nobody wants a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia for the obvious risks of nuclear that we talked about. But I think people are not going to lose interest in this or feel anything other than the fact that the outcome of this conflict is absolutely fundamental for the future security architecture of the European continent.
Anton, do you think that given the fact that there's a lot of speculation this conflict is going to carry on, it's going to be a long-term conflict? Afghanistan was a long conflict that Russian people had to go through. Do you think that the Russian people at the moment are prepared to go through a conflict like that? Are they going to tolerate something like that?
That's a very good question. I can certainly say that Russians do not quite understand the scope of the conflict, the cost of the conflict. I mean, sanctions only started to be manifested in the country. I mean, they are expected to be seen more in the summer and probably even more so in the fall. So this is probably the horizon that we should be looking at, because up until the fall and maybe the winter, it would not be sort of catastrophic for the Russian economy, and it could be bearable for the propaganda to manage the expectations of the people. If it takes longer than that, it's going to be highly problematic. I mean, we're seeing Kremlin react to any sort of sign of dissent at home and is trying to create a picture of total unity behind the cause, which is understood by the majority of Russians as Russia's fighting NATO in Ukraine. That's a proxy war to defend Russia. I mean, a lot of propaganda there being involved, but I don't think it is something that Russia can endure for a very long time. So it is critical to support and supply Ukraine for as long as possible so we could stop Russia's advance on the ground militarily, buying it more time. And the more time Ukraine can resist, the less likely it would be for Russia to be able to maintain its pressure on Ukraine long term.
Anton Babushin, thank you very much indeed. And I want to say thanks to all our guests, Peter Zalmayev, David O'Sullivan and Anton Babushin. And thank you to you two for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is at AJ Inside Story. From me, Rob Matheson, and the entire team here in Doha, goodbye for now.